From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You think the relationship between the Deseret News and the Salt Lake Tribune is a little frosty today? You should have seen it in the 1800s. For a time, you almost couldn't read a Tribune editorial without some nasty comment about the other paper. One Tribune editor in print called his counterpart at the Des the bastard in charge of the news and a psalm-singing male prostitute. And the fights weren't just confined to the papers. People got beat up on the streets of Salt Lake City over these squabbles. The historian Will Bagley knows the stories, and today in the program he's going to join us to tell some of them. We're exploring the history of the relationship between the Tribune and the Deseret News today, which is a revealing cycle of war and peace, and some of it will surprise you. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
Radio West, I'm Doug Fabrizio. Over the past few weeks, we've been covering the story of a new business arrangement struck between the Deseret News and the international hedge fund that owns the Salt Lake Tribune. It's an arrangement that dramatically shifted the profit-sharing equation for the two papers. And we figured that an important part of this story, of course, is the history of the relationship between the two papers. For one thing, there are a lot of colorful characters and dramatic stories. There are secret deals and book burnings and fistfights. But it also may say something about the importance of having different views represented by the organizations who are collecting and covering the news of this place. The historian Will Bagley says, in fact, it was the tension between these differing perspectives that, in fact, created the social conditions we're all familiar with here in Utah. The society we know is, in some ways, a byproduct of the newspaper wars. We've invited Will Bagley back today. We had him on the program just a few weeks ago, but he knows this story pretty well. We also invite you to join us if you have your own stories or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. You can also interact with us during the program by following us on Twitter at Radio West. Will Bagley is an independent historian, the author of numerous books. He's written and presented papers about the history of Utah's two largest newspapers. And we should also say that he was a former columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune for about 4 years. He wrote a history column for the paper. And Will Bagley, welcome back to you. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
Well, I got that one disclosure out of the way. I guess I should also mention your brother, Pat, is the political cartoonist for the Tribune, who's been outspoken, we should say, in his opposition to this recent arrangement between the two papers.
Brother's outspoken? Where did he get that?
Wanted to get that out of the way. So one of the issues that seems to have, and this is something I mentioned there just a moment ago, it seems to have kind of defined the history of Utah's newspapers, is this issue that you've talked about of unity. How, as you've said, Mormonism, when they established themselves here in this place, they had this idea that they wanted a unified community. And they weren't entirely sure what to do with dissent, which naturally comes up, obviously. But unity is that's what they were hoping for. That was the ideal.
Yes. And unanimous elections are still what you see in Mormon ward houses. They also, when they controlled the politics very tightly, they had unanimous elections so that Utah's delegates to Congress, the other officers who were elected, would be endorsed by the church, and then they would receive unanimous votes. My friend David Bigler wrote about one election where it was 49,889 to 1. And as he said, somebody obviously didn't get the word. But Mormonism also has had an extremely difficult relationship with internal dissenters and external opposition. And it's easy to see why they would be paranoid about opposition.
Well, opposition, that it defined their early days, this idea of opposition. So they were uneasy about it, I suppose, from early on. I mean, they were, you know, they went from place to place. And I just you've talked about that, and I think that's an important bit of context to understand.
Well, they had a hard time getting along with their neighbors. Even more, they truly feared internal dissent. Therefore, you have brutal oppression of opposition movements like the Morrisites, who they conjure up a arrest warrant for the leaders of the movement, John Morris and John Banks, and they send the territorial militia up. They bombard the camp for 3 days and then assault. They launch an assault, and within an hour, Banks and Morris are dead, and the territorial sheriff, Robert Burton, a woman, as he's shooting Banks, not Banks, but Morris, comes up and yells at him, "This is another Mountain Meadows massacre," and he turns around and shoots her too. So you have a very contentious environment.
We're going to get to the particular stories, but give us a broad overview of this relationship, because there are moments of suspicion, and we'll talk about this. You have physical violence in those early days, but also there's an era of detente, a sense of unity, a time when they really did get along pretty well. And you have a sense that there's kind of a cycle going on in some way.
History repeats itself. There is an absolutely phenomenal article written 12 years ago today, exactly, or published 12 years ago today in the Salt Lake Tribune. And it was written by some of the truly great journalists that have staffed the Tribune. And they, in this case, it was Michael Vye, Elizabeth Neff, and Kristen Moulton, who I think is still producing great journalism. It was called Paper Chase, How the Tribune Slipped Away from a Family and Why the D-News Took Advantage. The Tribune faces uncertainty. Option ruled valid. So now what? And ironically, here we are 12 years later, and the question is, so now what? The survival of the Salt Lake Tribune hangs in the balance. And as Paper Chase, this article, points out, the Deseret News conspired to strangle the independent voice of the Salt Lake Tribune.
Well, that's the contention.
No, no. That's what history shows. This was, of course, 12 to 15 years ago. But these were conscious decisions by church corporate leaders who felt that any criticism equaled anti-Mormonism.
I want to come back to that because I want to get us back a little further. You've described Utah's story as this contest between – you have two groups and a very large group in the middle.
Yes.
The LDS Church on one side. You've got the sort of non-Mormon, or maybe you could even say even anti-Mormon community on the other. But then there's this big chunk in the middle. Let's start with that first group, the Mormon Church, who began the Deseret News –
1850.
1850. Does it begin as a legitimate news organization, or it came to be known as the church organ?
Yes.
So what was the intent? What did they want out of the Deseret News in those early days?
They wanted a spokes newspaper. They wanted a way to express their voice and to put their spin on the news, because they were already being entangled in national politics. Utah was part of the Missouri Compromise, which is what created Utah Territory, a vast area reaching from the crest of the Rocky Mountains in today's Colorado all the way to the California border in the Sierra Nevada. So Mormons have always been very conscious of politics. Joseph Smith, the founding prophet, ran for president. Brigham Young repeatedly told people as the Civil War began that within 7 years he would be president of the United States. And early Mormon or early Mormons devoutly believed that they would not only live to see Jesus Christ's return, but they would live to see theocracy implemented worldwide so that God would rule through his selected leaders. Now, non-Mormons were uncomfortable with these developments, and they rallied to offer alternatives. Ironically, the most dramatic incident of a newspaper speaking out for people who felt threatened by church leaders occurred in Nauvoo when Mayor General, soon to be President, Joseph Smith had the Nauvoo Legion destroy the press office of the Expositor, the Nauvoo Expositor, which had printed a series of articles on polygamy that were have been validated by historians. They were threatening to – no, they were promising to expose Smith's political schemes. And to this day, we don't have the minutes of the – what's called the Kingdom of God or the Council of 50. And when we do, we will have a remarkable insight into the ambitions of early Mormon prophets. But – it's this opposition, the sense that if you oppose us, you're opposing the will of the Lord. Yeah. So that makes you evil and justifies pretty much any tactic that would lead the cause of righteousness to triumph.
It's interesting you talk about how the church created these spinoff papers in the early days so they could, and this is how you've put it, get down in the mud.
That's what they did. The Deseret News wanted to be a respectable paper and maintain a voice of dignity to represent the church. So you had a series. This was the frontier. Yeah. Newspapers were everywhere. The smallest mining camps would have their own publications, and they'd vigorously represent one political philosophy or another. And if you had one successful, what we'd call today, left-wing newspaper, you would immediately – it would immediately attract a right-wing paper. But in Salt Lake, the first opposition newspaper is the Valley Tan, which is started after the Utah expedition reaches Utah. It started in late 1858. And it starts out saying we want to be a community newspaper. We want to represent everybody. Very quickly, they figure out that the Mormons are not going to be interested in news that does not flatter them. But at the same time, they have a hard time getting newsprint. And the church is – Deseret News provides it. And I think sometimes even printed the Valley Tan on the church's presses. But there's one issue, one story that really, really aggravates Mormon leaders, and it's the Mountain Meadows Massacre. The Kirk Anderson, who founds the Valley Tan, quickly becomes unpopular, and for business reasons, the paper is not a great financial success. He decides to decamp, and he sells and passes through a string of editors who are generally also the owners. And finally, it lands with a man who's later Robert N. Baskin's business or law partner. I believe his name's Wolf. And he prints on February 1860, the report by territorial acting marshal Billy Rogers of his visit to Mountain Meadows. It's still one of the most devastating accounts of what actually happened. This, of course, did not sit well with the authorities, and it was the last issue of the Valley Tan ever published. What was interesting is a BYU grad student did a paper that was published in the Utah Historical Quarterly, and he, because the church had not microfilmed this particular issue, he assumed that the Valley Tan closed a week before it actually did. But to oppose this, the Deseret News didn't get down and dirty. They created the Mountaineer, which was led by three fascinating early Mormons. Hosey Stout, who was the arm of the law as it was in Utah. Seth Blair, who had been a Texas Ranger, was a good friend of Sam Houston and had gotten Houston involved in opposing raising troops to support the Utah War. And finally, James Ferguson, who at the time was General James Ferguson, but he'd served as staff sergeant, the chief of enlisted men in the Mormon battalion, and was one of the most colorful and brilliant characters in Utah's history, leading man in the local theater, eloquent, beautiful writer, passionate Irishman.
And they start a paper? They're the ones in charge of this Mountaineer.
Mountaineer. All these newspapers, by the way, are now easily accessible through the Utah Digital Newspaper Project, which is a phenomenal contribution. And the Mountaineer is full of very interesting information on overland immigration, Utah cultural affairs, conflicts between the federal laws authorities and the Mormon establishment. And Ferguson, you can really see the quality of his writing, but he's a total alcoholic, and he drinks himself to death before he's 35 years old, shortly after the Mountaineer has collapsed financially. Next, we have Utah's first daily newspaper, the Union Vidette. A vidette is a sentry, a warning, and it is started by the newspaper men who were in the California Volunteers that found Fort Douglas in late 1862. It starts up, I believe, in 1863 as a weekly, but quickly becomes a daily newspaper. This demands that the church start the Salt Lake Telegram, which is, or maybe it's a telegraph.
Telegraph. Telegram, I think is what you said.
Yeah. It's a brilliant journalist named T.B.H. Stenhouse, who has been the church's PR guy for a long time. He's the intellect of the church, and he is introduced to all the leading visitors, Horace Greeley, Richard Burton, anybody who's important who comes through Salt Lake, meets both Porter Rockwell and Stenhouse. Stenhouse is the source for several Mormon legends about Lincoln saying that he would plow around the Mormons during the Civil War. That story is credited to Stenhouse, but Stenhouse never wrote it. And it was, in fact, lifted from the memoirs of one of Lincoln's aides. And Stenhouse finally has enough, and in the late 1860s goes over the fence, writes a massive history of Utah called The Rocky Mountain Saints. And it's a very useful Utah source book, because it is what an insider knew about what the shenanigans of Mormon authority and theocracy.
There's a group in the middle, the dissenters. They begin the paper that's going to become the Salt Lake Tribune, or what we know today as the Salt Lake Tribune. First, it's called the Mormon Tribune.
Yes.
In 1870. So the Salt Lake Tribune actually begins as the Mormon Tribune, and these are Mormons, but they're dissident Mormons. They offer a kind of dissent.
They are what are now called Godbeites, and there were a group of very, very wealthy Mormon merchants who had made their money speculating in overland freighting, and there was huge money to be made. Businessmen of all sides, Mormon and non-Mormon, are making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in profit. I think the New York Times prints a correspondent who says if a man can't make $100,000 a season in overland immigration, he's not trying very hard. And of course, the church has its own system in place and is trying to get a big cut of this business. My ancestors came over in what are called the down and back trains, and they were essentially human cargo stuffed in among the freight that was profiting the Mormon oligarchy.
But these are dissidents. These are dissidents who start this paper.
These are people who are tired of being told by Daniel Wells that the voice of Brigham is the voice of God, and he has the right to dictate to you everything, including your business policies. Young at this time has decided that it would be a good idea to cut the average worker's pay from $4 a day to $1 a day. Now, believe it or not, there were working people in Utah who thought that cutting their wages by three quarters was not fair. So these men, who are also spiritualists, there's an enormous religious movement based on contacting spirits. It's tied in with the Civil War, where hundreds of thousands, three quarters of a million casualties generate this massive spiritual dislocation. And it's answered by communicating with spirits. The combination of these two elements is seen as a definite threat by the Mormon establishment. So Godby, E.L.T. Harrison, who'd been a journalist himself, there's any number of exceptionally talented, Edward Tullidge, who becomes one of Utah's leading historians, form what they call the Church of Zion, try to reform Mormonism. And
they have a paper. I mean, I guess the point is they have a paper.
They found a paper. Yeah. They start with a magazine. They move up to a paper. And they are roundly excommunicated in City Hall and condemned to the buffetings of Satan. But they're solid businessmen, but they're not great journalists. And they're uncomfortable because of the threats that come their way. And by 1870, they've sold the paper, which becomes the Salt Lake Tribune and Mining Gazette.
Yeah. Now, this is a group that this is the other group. These are three Kansans.
That's 1873.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And they're the border ruffians.
Yeah. And they they take over the paper.
Yes. Border ruffian was an insult for slavocrats who went to Kansas and fought the free soil people. So it's a very inappropriate insult to throw at three quite respectable journalists who really can come out simply to do some journalism.
Yeah. One of them is a man by the name of Frederick Lockley.
Lockley is one of the great colorful characters of Utah journalism. He served a distinguished service in the Army of the Potomac. He's an English immigrant. He's a self-educated son of a London butcher. He is a fantastic writer and a man of both talent and courage. As
he also loved a pretty juicy headline.
He liked to fight. Well, this is a guy who had taken the part of the Indian in Kansas when that was a little bit like being sympathetic to the Taliban, let's say. Maybe it was even worse than that in Kansas at the time. But he was a man with a profound sense of justice and what was right. He came into town. He wanted to understand the nature of the conflict between Mormons and non-Mormons. And you need to talk to Pat Lanahan. Pat Lanahan had a butcher shop. He was an Irishman. He was, of course, very popular with the Irish families that were then laying the groundwork of these enormous fortunes that in many ways create modern Salt Lake, certainly the surviving old architecture. comes from Jewish merchants and Irish mining magnates. So this dynamic non-Mormon culture is expanding very rapidly. Lanahan is an insightful guy. He later becomes publisher of the Salt Lake Tribune. But Lockley meets him, and Lanahan listens to what he says, and then he says, if you want to have a first-rate independent newspaper, you're going to have one fight on your hands. Or what's the exact quote? You're going to have one hell of a fight on your hands. And Lockley pretty quickly does. He goes to a city council meeting. He sees this enormous corruption that is being fostered by the man he will later call the one-eyed pirate of the Wasatch, General, President, Mayor Daniel H. Wells.
Who's also a Mormon general authority at the time. Is that right?
He's first presidency.
Yeah.
And he's Brigham's, the guy that's appointed to replace Brigham's hammer, Jedediah Grant, after he dies. And as several talented Utah historians have observed, when Wells shows up on the scene, bad things happen. But Wells is running this very corrupt, self-serving political machine that is countenancing immense corruption. One of his henchmen is a character named Dr. Jeter Clinton, who one of his earliest activities is to set up a health station at the mouth of Immigration Canyon where they quarantine people until they buy a shot of whiskey from Dr. Clinton. But anyway, Lockley quickly writes about this and is immediately persona non grata and is in big trouble.
Will Bagley is with us, an independent historian, author of numerous books, and we invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We need to take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring the history of the relationship between the Salt Lake Tribune and the Deseret News. Relevant today for obvious reasons, the Tribune's future is in question after a business arrangement between the papers was rearranged. We have the historian Will Bagley with us to put this story in perspective, and we spent a lot of time in the late 1800s. I want to sort of shift gears here in a moment to talk about this remarkable area of detente where they got along really well. Because that's an important part of the story. But you've got to tell a little bit about the fact that these relationships, these battles, weren't just confined to the newspaper. They often got
physical. They involved brass knuckles and savage beatings and attempted murder. And again, what's the igniting issue? The Mountain Meadows Massacre. Lockley covers the first trial of John D. Lee, publishes a long report on it. The trial is devastating to the reputation of Brigham Young, and Lockley is held accountable. The second trial is covered by an outside journalist named Jerome
Stilson.
B. Stilson or S. Stilson, you see it both ways, who's been Mark Twain says he'd been a distinguished war correspondent during the Civil War, brave, talented, able journalist. He is in his hotel room in Salt Lake, and he gets a knock on the door. He opens it. There's a stranger standing there, and the stranger hands him a piece of paper. He takes the paper and starts reading it, and it says, "Take that, you handsome son of a bitch!" And the stranger tries to stab him. Now, Stilson's story is that it's only his stout suspender buckle that saves his life. The news' story is, Stilson had hit the bar at noon, and he had been drinking. He'd bought a quart of whiskey, and he was and this stuff about a suspender buckle. Who's going to believe that? So you had both sides of the story. The most tragic, one of the most tragic elements of this conflict is the end of Fred Lockley's tenure with the Salt Lake Tribune. And he's kept up the fight for years until the late 1870s. And he is followed from his hotel room one night and attacked by two men and brutally beaten. The other Mountain Meadows story is involves the nephew of Brigham Young, who is John C. Young, who goes on to another brilliant career, but not in Salt Lake. And he is the Salt Lake Tribune's lead reporter at the second John D. Lee trial. And he is amazingly courageous. He's visiting Lockley when he gets back to Salt Lake one night. And Lockley recalls that whenever he went out on the street, Young had kept a revolver in his hand. But that night he didn't, and as he was walking down the street, he was jumped by two men with and pistol whipped with a silver pistol. Lockley says that they knew that it was the two sons of Angus Cannon, who later boasted about it and showed Dad the silver revolver they'd used. But out of this conflict, and it goes on until actually 1911, emerges the two modern newspapers. In 1900, the Tribune, which has been under the legacy of Charles C. Goodwin for a long time, alleges that the new senator, Thomas Kearns, who's a Catholic mining titan, has only gotten to be senator because he cut a political deal with the Mormons. Now, he certainly had to. He did. But he didn't like that being in the newspaper. So he
buys the paper?
Secretly. He secretly bought the paper. And then in 1904, the church decides that it might be more appropriate to have Apostle Reed Smoot fill that Senate seat.
Which he does.
Which he does. And this unleashes Thomas Kearns, who stands up, gets a reads a speech written by Frank Cannon, another great Utah journalist and colorful character, who's also gone over the fence. But Kearns then comes back and starts the American Party to try to, even after statehood, secure democracy in Utah. And there's a bitter 7-year campaign by the American Party, which has some victories. But in 1911, Kearns is looking at the balance sheet and realizes that they just can't keep up this political war. And he essentially declares peace, and the Tribune becomes much more accommodating.
But because I think there's an interesting part of that story, because so he arranges this ceasefire with the church in 1911, mm-hmm. Thomas Kearns. And the Tribune agrees to burn a warehouse full of books.
That's a story anyway. And one of the great characters in Utah newspaper history.
These were anti-Mormon books, we should point out.
Well,
they
were written by Josiah Gibbs, who'd been born in Nauvoo, served many Mormon missions, had been a loyal Mormon, declined to go to jail for polygamy, which didn't win him any points, but who had gotten crosswise with the new prophet, Joseph F. Smith, and was tackling, again, political Mormonism and business Mormonism. But Gibbs is another insider who offers great insight and, of course, brings up that nasty incident, the Mountain Meadows Massacre. By the way, as a plug, I cover a lot of this in Blood of the Prophets, my book, which has roused considerable controversy and a million and million and millions and million dollar rebuttal from the Mormon historical establishment, but still stands as the single best work on the subject.
If you say so yourself.
If I do. But Gibbs's book is provocative. And so the story is that they burn an entire warehouse full of these books, which they were using as political dynamite. Later, one of the great character of 20th century Utah history is a foster son of Thomas Kearns, a Jack Gallivan, John W. Gallivan, for years the publisher of the Salt Lake Tribune, always the mainspring and brains behind the long period of peace that that Gallivan is instrumental in forging under his mentor, who is John Fitzpatrick, who is editor from about 1924, I think, until his death in 1960. And this is that period that's so surprising, when you have two healthy newspapers representing two very different communities, but both focused on a common goal. And what's that goal? To make Utah a better place and to make Salt Lake a more prosperous home for business and education and culture. And both papers play individualistic but very, very important roles in representing a wide range of Utah voices.
There's a story that comes from this era in the late 40s, early 50s. The Deseret News is in real financial trouble at this time. There were reports that their circulation was down to something like 12,000 or just more than 12,000. And you say the Deseret News launched this promotional campaign, tried to sort of get themselves back in the game again. The ZCMI, which was, of course, church-owned, withdrew its support from the Salt Lake Tribune. So there was kind of a little squabble that went on. But then there's the story that plays out. I want you to tell it. David O. McKay, who's president of the LDS Church, goes to the hospital to see John Fitzpatrick. He's in the hospital. And he tells him the Deseret News is in trouble.
Yes.
It's a remarkable story. Tell that, would you?
He asked Fitzpatrick to buy the Deseret News. And I can imagine Fitzpatrick saying, "Now, David, why would I want to do that?"
And Fitzpatrick, they were friends, I guess, right?
They had lunch, breakfast once a week. This was an era where you could walk into the church office building on South Temple and be escorted in to talk to an apostle. It was when Mormon authorities walked the streets, had friends among the non-Mormon community, and were interested in people who represented a viewpoint other than those who were in the bubble. Now, church authorities are shielded in this carefully secured bubble that is also a media bubble in which they never talk to anybody who's going to question their inspired decisions. It is simply not healthy. But in these days, you had a leader like McKay who had been an educator. He wasn't a corporate attorney or a PR expert. He was an educator. And he had deep rural roots that represented in many ways this old model of 20th century country Mormonism. And he and Fitzpatrick hit it off. They'd both been immensely successful in their careers. And when McKay would propose that, well, they're thinking about building a place where the Salt Palace, or the Art Center, the Bravenel Hall now stands, so that they can handle overflow from conference. And what Gallivan and Fitzpatrick put together lays the foundation for creation of the Salt Palace and later the Bravenel Hall, which is on church land. And McKay makes the arrangement to provide a long-term, very low-cost lease.
I think this is important. So they are engaged in two differing perspectives, Mormon perspective, non-Mormon perspective, but they're coming together in these civic projects.
Exactly. Gallivan told me that he and Gus Backus, who was president of the
Chamber of Commerce,
and he was a devout Mormon, did a count. They thought, well, we got to get the Olympics to come to Salt Lake. This is before there even is a Park City attempt to turn it into a ski resort. But you have Alta and you have these phenomenal world-class resorts. So they do a survey of how many hotel rooms there are in Salt Lake. In the entire city, there are 2,000. There are now, I don't know what, 70,000, 80,000 hotel rooms. And they begin changing the commercial nature of downtown with an eye to getting the Olympics. And they do it, start almost 40 years or maybe before 40 years before there is, we actually do get the Olympics. But there is, it's a united effort to improve Utah and its environment. You also have very different perspectives represented by the Deseret News and the Salt Lake Tribune. The Tribune is, of course, owned by a family whose wealth comes out of the ground, Utah Mines, and it represents the mining interests. It never questions Kennecott. It welcomes U.S. Steel in Geneva, but the Salt Lake or the Deseret News represents a very old tradition among the Mormons of environmental protection and taking care of the earth. Now, there's a story that Brigham Young, on the way out of Salt Lake, going back east for the last time in 1847, stops and writes out a decree because he's heard that they're chopping down the trees along City Creek. And he says, don't cut any more timber in the Salt Lake watershed because it's too important. We have to drink that water. It's important to us. The first serious air quality issues begin in Salt Lake when the smelters, which are choking farmers in Murray and in Magna, bring lawsuits. And they're supported, of course, by the Deseret News. They're not supported by the Salt Lake Tribune. This surprising environmentalism continues all the way up until the 1990s.
It's also interesting that, as you've said in the past, that the Salt Lake Tribune had an era when it was virulently racist,
yes,
in contrast to,
yes,
the Mormon-owned Deseret News.
Yes. The Mormon newspapers, for complex reasons, were very sympathetic to Indians. And if you want, as a historian working on Mormons and Indians, I find the best representation of the Indian viewpoint in the pages of the Salt Lake Herald, which was an opposition paper the Mormons set up to fight the Tribune, and the Deseret News. You have great statements by the Indians themselves that are invaluable to try to capture that elusive voice of the American Indians as they were fighting the attempts to destroy their culture and incarcerate them on reservations, which are really sort of big concentration camps. But the Mormons, for their own theological reasons, are very sympathetic to the Indians. The other surprise is that despite its very racist theological doctrines at the time,
The ban on the priesthood.
The ban, yeah, on the priesthood. It welcomes the appearance of the Buffalo Soldiers, the 24th Infantry that were stationed at Camp Douglas in the 1890s. Now, the Salt Lake Tribune goes crazy and issues all these racist rants, but President Wilford Woodruff invites a man named Ainsworth, Colonel Ainsworth, who is the black chaplain of the Buffalo Soldiers, to visit him in the Gardo House, which is the official residence of the Mormon prophet at the time, and they have a very amicable discussion, and it's favorably reported in the news. So you have a breadth of opinion reflected in this dynamic newspaper environment.
Will Bagley is with us, independent historian, author of a number of books, and we need to take another quick break. We'll get some final thoughts when we get back. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with historian Will Bagley. We're talking about the historical relationship between the Salt Lake Tribune and the Deseret News. I wanted you to finish that story because you started telling the story of David O. McKay, LDS Church president, goes to the hospital bed of John Fitzpatrick, who's then head of the publisher of the Salt Lake Tribune. McKay says, please buy the Deseret News to the Salt Lake Tribune. Now, John Fitzpatrick's doesn't, but they work out what turns out to be this joint operating agreement that was renegotiated back in October.
And it becomes a remarkably important element of newspaper history in America, because the foundation of that joint operating agreement is to keep two healthy newspapers, morning paper, evening paper. Jack Gallivan writes much of the initial legislation, which I think is published in or passed in the early 50s. And it uses the model that was set up of sharing a production plant and advertising revenues with between two newspapers and dividing it up based roughly on their share of the circulation. It's fascinating that the cultural interactions in the old newspaper agency corporation involved the grandson of Thomas Kearns, who sold ads for the Salt Lake Tribune, and Thomas S. Monson, who was an ad executive for the Deseret News. And they became friends. They knew each other well. It was good. But by 1972, Gallivan wanted to institutionalize this, and he wrote what he wanted to call the Dying Newspaper Act. But the
Newspaper Preservation Act is the actual word.
That was the acceptable name. And this set up a national system that violated antitrust laws but did keep any number of competing newspapers alive in probably hundreds of Americans.
Well, we don't have a lot of time left. Give us a quick thumbnail sketch of what happens. When does the Jack Gallivan period sort of end, or that period of detente? What happens that brings us to this sort of ratcheting up of tensions between the two papers?
Well, Jay Shelley happens. Jay Shelley is hired, I believe, in 1990. He's been a newspaper editor for the Kearns Media Empire up in Idaho. And he comes in and he wants to treat the corporation of the president, the LDS Church, just like any other news story, and they begin publishing some pretty hard-hitting stories. And he hires me in 2000 to replace Harold Schindler. But at the same time, Jay was a great journalist, and as one reporter told me, with the survival instincts of a cockroach. And he survives the turnover and the takeover by Media News for a while.
But he ratchets up the tensions between the two, and the detente essentially is over.
It wasn't intended. It was simply to say, look, this is a major power in politics and economics and everything else. Let's treat it like any other entity and story. And the Mormon Church doesn't like that. It wants special privileges. And those of us who don't accommodate that earn the wrath.
You mentioned how in the early days the Deseret News was known as the church organ. What do you make of where the paper is today? Have we sort of come back full circle?
Well, I am very clearly a partisan. The Salt Lake Tribune means an awful lot to me. I began reading in the 1950s. I got my love of history from two things, the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune, which had a lot of history, and marching in the Children's Pioneer Day Parade. My brothers worked for it. I had a great run as a columnist for 4 years. But why is it essential that we have two competing healthy newspapers. Well, Trent Harris fortunately pointed out to me.
He's a filmmaker in town, for those who don't know.
And a truly wise man, pointed out to me that on Friday, the lead headline above the cut in the Salt Lake Tribune was "Complaint to Target Lee Campaign." And this goes into the details of the fact that sleazy money was being funneled to our junior senator.
Now, Senator Mike Lee.
Senator Mike Lee. A John D. Lee descendant. Who knew? But anyway, so what do we find in the pages of the Deseret News? Above the cut, we hear, court puts hold on recognizing gay marriages. Righteousness triumphs. But below is this headline. Lee Interfaith Group meet with Pope Francis. Senator from Utah on tour of Europe to promote prayer. Oh, but there's an accompanying photograph, and it's got the senator shaking hands with Pope Francis, and the Pope looks like he's going, as soon as this guy quits crushing my fingers, I'm going to count how many rings I have left.
Well, okay, you got a bigger point there.
We need a voice that's going to be serious journalism and not a propaganda sheet. And what the corporate geniuses that are running Bonneville Communications now have made a conscious decision that they're going to promote the heck out of Mormonism. And they don't care to have anyone oppose that. And the history, which we didn't get into about the conflict of what happened, is documented in an article 12 years ago today, is that the church had decided to crush the Salt Lake Tribune. That Chairman Snar had made a conscious decision that if he couldn't buy the Salt Lake Tribune, he was going to find a stalking horse to run it as a client of the powers that be. So this is why it's so important that we have investigative journalism alive and well, not just in Utah, but in the United States of America.
It's Will Bagley, independent historian, author of a number of books, and joined us here in the studio. Will, thanks very much. Radio West is a production of KUER News, technical direction from Mike Anderson, our theme music composed by The Moth and The Flame. Michael Shea is our intern, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.